Good afternoon. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. Glad you are hanging. I am grateful. You know, it's long been known that physical activity comes with a multitude of benefits for our physical and mental health. Those who get out there and get moving improve their heart health, lower their risk of chronic diseases, and generally improve their frame of mind. But all that moving, of course, can sometimes lead to injuries. Well, today it's another edition of What Hurts Today, the show for weekend triathletes, after-school soccer players, company league softballers, swimmers, runners, golfers, and anyone who gets out there and plays hard or at least tries to. So what hurts today, of course, could be different than what hurt yesterday, might be different than what hurts next week. But this won't hurt. This is great news. We have once again invited Dr. Miho Tanaka to the show. She's an orthopedic surgeon who has worked with professional and amateur athletes alike. Dr. Tanaka is the director of the Women's Sports Medicine Program at Massachusetts General Hospital and an associate professor at the Harvard Medical School. She's also the chief medical officer for the New England Revolution pro soccer team and a physician for the Boston Red Sox, the Boston Ballet, and a professional frisbee team, the Boston Glory. So if you have questions for Dr. Tanaka about what hurts and how to keep things from hurting in the future, give us a call. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And Dr. Miho Tanaka joins us on Zoom from Boston. Miho, welcome back to the show. It's so great to talk to you.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You know, and it's an interesting day to be talking about this topic because NPR just reporting that the world's oldest marathoner, Faujit Singh, who died at the age of 114, not of old age, but of, because of a hit-and-run accident, was the first person to complete a marathon over the age of 100. And he didn't run his first one, and I think until he was 89. So it shows you can start any old time, and do any old thing you want if your mind is set to it. So God bless him, but isn't that amazing? Wow. I want to ask you, before we start, because you are, not only a practicing orthopedic surgeon, but you do a lot of teaching and lecturing all around the world. You've been on a whirlwind trip I think you've been out of town for like 6 weeks or something, long time, giving, talks and you're really on top of research. What is the research climate like for people in orthopedics, for people in medicine? You're at Harvard, which is a great brunt of President Trump's ire about research. What's the scene like?
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, I can't speak on behalf of the institution, but in general, you know, I think everyone is very nervous. You know, research is one of those things, at least in the hospitals, that have always been an area that is a little bit difficult to keep going, meaning that, you know, it's not something that brings in money the same way that, you know, providing medical services does. But it's such an important part of how we advance medicine and how we, you know, find new ways to approach surgeries and treatments and things like that. But I think that this has been, you know, already a challenge kind of leading up to this time in terms of how do we find a way that is sustainable, you know, to keep research going. And of course, with grants, that has traditionally been the way. But now that that is in jeopardy, I think there is, you know, some angst about that. But also, you know, people kind of digging in to kind of find other ways to support what is really kind of vital to what we do as in medicine.
I mean, are there resources in the private sector that can make up or begin to make up what the government was funding through, you know, things like the NIH, et cetera? It just seems like, you know, I mean, here in Baltimore, Johns Hopkins, an institution you used to be affiliated with, has lost an estimated $1 billion in government contracts and funding for research. I mean, you just can't imagine that those kinds of sums can be made up.
Right. Yeah. No, it is challenging. There absolutely are different ways to obtain funding that is outside of federal funding. A lot of societies will fund grants. Research societies or medical societies do allocate some money that they can, give, but it's usually not in the same order that you would see from NIH grants, which could be, $2, $3 million. I think philanthropy has always been some way that certain hospitals have been able to kind of support it as well. But yeah, I think that, now there are, like I said, there are kind of organizations that are becoming a little bit more creative. I think certain some hospitals are talking about how they could maybe subsidize or support, their researchers kind of during these times of uncertainty. But I think there is a lot of that uncertainty, and we're just going to have to kind of wait and see, how things go.
Sure. You do so much. I mean, when I read the things that you're involved in, I feel like I need to take a nap. I mean, it just gets so you're just so out there. And one of the things you do in addition to all that stuff is I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you're now the editor in chief for the Journal of Women's Sports Medicine. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
On
Yeah.
top of everything else. But I wonder, I mean, has that journal seen a decrease, any sort of innovation in the amount of research that people are doing, the kind of research that people are doing? I mean, how has it affected that very important publication to your field?
Yeah, well, that publication is fairly new. The journal was founded in 2021. And honestly, it was designed to kind of fill a niche that is growing. I would say that because it's fairly small and because it's a very narrow area of focus, there haven't been maybe a lot of eyes on that in the same way that, would make us worried. I would say, if anything, there have been a pretty steady stream of papers coming in and that are kind of growing off of, each sort of each issue. There's kind of growth in terms of the types of papers that we see. So far we haven't seen any sort of slowdown there, but again, I think, we'll have to see how things go. But so far we've been really lucky with
Well,
that.
I'm glad to hear that. Dr. Miho Tanaka is my guest. She's an orthopedic surgeon and an associate professor of medicine at the Harvard Medical School. If you have questions, we are calling our show today with a bit of tongue in cheek. What hurts today? Our number 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wipr.org. So, Miho, let me ask you about seasonal injuries. I mean, sometimes we talk in the winter, sometimes we talk in the summer. This is the heat of the year, the heat of the season. Are there injuries that you tend to see more in the summer hot months than you see at other times of year? What should folks be on the lookout for?
Yeah, so I think, as an orthopedic surgeon, there are certain types of injuries to joints or, muscles that we may or may not see, but that's more related to the sport or the summer season. But I would say, just in terms of general exercise, one of the biggest things that I would caution about is muscle cramping. And people don't always realize, the risk of muscle cramps when they're out there running in the heat or exercising or playing basketball or something like that. And so this, is usually contributed to not just by heat, but by dehydration as well. And so if it is hot or if it is humid, you do have to take a lot more precautions in terms of how you are hydrating, how you're preparing, how you're making sure you're warming up and you're stretching as well before you get back to your normal activities, a little bit differently than you might consider doing on an average non-hot and muggy day.
Yeah, and hydration, of course, couldn't be
Yeah.
more important at this time of year,
Yeah.
And it's funny how dehydration sneaks up on you. I mean, sometimes you don't even realize you're dehydrated until almost it's too late.
Right.
So keep that water going and the Gatorade and whatever else you use. You've also given interviews and talked about selecting the kinds of exercise you do, the kinds of workouts you have. Based on the kind of body you have, based on the need that you have, the particulars of your individual situation. How do you frame those decisions?
Yeah, so I think what you're referring to is, there was a time when I talked about kind of high impact versus low impact activities. And, that really refers to not the intensity of the exercise, but really how much force is being placed through your joints. So, for example, one of the highest impact activities would be something like running or jumping, where you're landing, you're really requiring your joints and your muscles to absorb that shock during that landing. And then, in contrast, something like a low impact activity would be something like swimming, where you can still get a great workout from it, but you're not putting that sort of same stress on your joints. And I think that understanding that is very helpful, especially if you have any sort of joint problems. So, as we age, many of us will start to get some arthritis. It doesn't mean that you have to have a knee or a hip replacement, but it might indicate that, you just don't absorb shock as well when you're doing exercises like running, and that might, a lot of running might lead to knee pain or hip pain and things like that. And so in those settings, or if you do have any problems with your joints, switching over to a low impact exercise like swimming or getting on the bike or even the elliptical is fairly low impact. Those are all ways that you can continue to exercise, continue to get a good cardio workout and stay fit without necessarily having your joints bear the brunt of that stress.
And I think it's also true that there are some conditions that really do benefit from high impact
Yes.
exercise. I mean, bone health, I know, is something that responds better to high impact things like running and jumping rather than low impact. Why is that? How does high impact affect bone health?
Yeah, you're exactly right. So, bones and muscles respond to stress. Just like we stress the muscles during exercise, and that's how we get them to get stronger, the bone is the same way. So having some impact and weight-bearing exercises can be very healthy for building up the muscle and the bone. And especially when you're doing things that are very high impact, if you think about like CrossFit type exercises where you're, jumping and doing those things, it does also build kind of the explosive muscles, and it can tend to build muscles a little bit faster, which is why a lot of people really like those sorts of high intensity, high impact exercises. But like with everything, it can have a downside. And so for people who are going to kind of get into high impact activities, I think that balancing that out with rest days or off days where maybe you're doing low impact and alternating and cross training is equally important, because even though high impact activities can give you those benefits, it definitely can have the downsides that we talked about earlier as well in terms of joint health.
Because there is a difference between low impact and low intensity. I mean,
Exactly.
you can do low impact things like swimming, but swimming, boy, I used to swim. I don't swim very much anymore, but it really wears you out. I mean, it's, and swimming, I'm told, I've always been told that swimming is kind of like the ideal exercise because it's very difficult to hurt yourself swimming, I guess. Although I'm sure if I tried hard enough, I could do it. I'm confident in my ability to screw anything up. But you can still have a very intense workout and burn a bunch of calories, even if it is a low impact endeavor.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, low impact doesn't mean low intensity. And so there are plenty of activities where you can get a great workout, get in a good cardio workout without having to use your joints or put stress on your joints. And that is something that is, really recommended for people who are trying to maintain their fitness. Of course, we do always caution that if you're about to start exercise, though, and you haven't really been involved with high intensity activities, you still want to make sure that you're checking with your doctor. And especially if you have had any sort of heart or lung conditions in the past, the intensity is something that you may want to kind of take up carefully and with caution and within kind of a plan with progression of that, so that you're not taking that on too quickly.
Because high impact exercise doesn't necessarily mean you're going to burn more calories than low impact exercise, depending on what you do. Because a lot of folks, are exercising in part to lose or control their weight. But if you've got joint problems, a lot of times the joint problems are exacerbated if you're a few pounds overweight as well. So you got to balance all this stuff.
Right. That's exactly right.
Yeah, and that's I hate balance. I hate restraint. I can't stand being rational or any of that stuff. So very, very difficult for guys like me. We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back and we'll have more with Dr. Miho Tanaka. She's an orthopedic surgeon who's on the faculty of the Harvard Medical School. She directs the Women's Sports Medicine Program at Massachusetts General Hospital, and she's a physician with the Boston Ballet and several professional sports teams in Boston. So this quick break, when we come back, we will once again ask you, what hurts today? And you can let us know by giving us a buzz, 410-662-8780, or dropping us an email, midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WIPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the show tomorrow, we're going to head back to the garden with Farmer Chippy of Plantation Park Heights Urban Farm and Carrie Engel of Valley View Farms up in Cockeysville. If you're planting peppers or seeding sunflowers or trimming trees, give us a call, drop us a note with any and all questions you might have about any and all things horticultural. So that's coming up tomorrow. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about what hurts. Is it a knee, a shoulder, a back, an ankle, an elbow? Let us know. Whatever's hurting, Dr. Miho Tanaka is here to answer your questions about it. She is the director of the Women's Sports Medicine Program at Massachusetts General Hospital and the former director of the Women's Sports Medicine Program at Johns Hopkins. When she lived here in Baltimore, she worked with the Baltimore Orioles. She's also worked with the St. Louis Cardinals and two WNBA teams. Dr. Tanaka is currently the chief medical officer for the New England Revolution. That's a professional soccer team up in Boston. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. If you have a question you'd like to drop us an email about, it's midday@wipr.org. So, Miho, you're well-versed in many things orthopedic, virtually all things orthopedic, but as I understand it, your specialty is the patellofemoral joint, and you do a lot of work with the biomechanics and the sort of the things around patellofemoral pain syndrome, called PFPS, which is known in lay circles as runner's knee. So my guess is we've got a few folks listening right now who've had their interaction with runner's knee. Tell us what it is, how you get it, and how you get rid of it.
Yeah, so runner's knee is one of those really challenging conditions that almost, you know, a lot of people get this. It's reported that about 50% of people get this during their adolescent years, and then in their adult years, maybe a third. So it's something that really, you know, it affects a lot of people. And essentially what it is inflammation under the kneecap. And the kneecap sees a lot of load during impact type activities like the ones that we were just talking about, especially with running. And so that's why we call it runner's knee. We typically see this when somebody might be ramping up and they're either doing too much or maybe doing a little bit more than their knees are ready to do. And so with that, then the knee can kind of develop some inflammation that sits under the kneecap, and this can lead to some pretty painful symptoms. Usually people will say that, you know, the onset is like after they start running, maybe towards the end of the run. In worst cases, you know, it lingers even afterwards. And it's pretty specific to kind of the front of the knee. Under the kneecap, people will say that it's worse with squatting and kneeling, running, of course, and especially with sitting with your knees bent for a prolonged period of time. That can also be a marker of that. And even though this is a really painful condition, the treatment is almost always non-surgical, with the goal of getting rid of the inflammation that's under the kneecap, either with medications or injections. But the mainstay of treatment is actually physical therapy, because for most most people, the way that this develops is that they tend to have some sort of muscle imbalances that cause the muscle to not be able to absorb all of the stress that's being put onto the legs during the running. And that stress then gets transferred to the kneecaps. And this is kind of how that sort of builds up from there. So usually with the course of anti-inflammatories and a course of physical therapy, this is something that generally can go away in about 6 to 8 weeks for most people. But obviously runners especially may have to kind of build up their training volume subsequently.
Let me ask you to explain a little more what a muscle imbalance is.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So typically what we see in runners who have this problem is that if you test their strength, especially their quadricep strength, which is the muscle along the front of the thigh, we're going to notice that there's a little bit of a deficit on one side. It might not be enough where somebody is limping, but it's more the muscle control and the way they're able to use their knee. And people are always surprised to know that also in addition to the quadriceps and hamstring muscles, the hip muscle, the abductor and the muscles that control the hip are also equally important in controlling what happens in the knee, especially when you're running. And so if any of those muscles are weak or have become a little overloaded and have become irritated and subsequently weak, then that side-to-side difference, really becomes pronounced when you're running. Because obviously as you're running, you're taking tens of thousands of steps and you're taking the same number of steps on each leg. And so of course the weaker one is going to see more of that sort of differential and that sort of increased stress on that side, which generally gets transferred to the knee joint, which is what leads to these symptoms, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and of course, all these muscles are so interconnected. I mean, quadriceps,
yeah.
your hamstrings can also affect your lower back.
Exactly.
If your hamstrings are tight, it can make your back hurt and it could make your knee hurt. So stretching,
right,
again, is probably a pretty good idea for most folks.
Yeah, absolutely. I think stretching, making sure that you can, keep your muscles balanced, making sure that you're stretching equally on both sides and really putting, kind of paying attention to the stretches while you're doing them to make sure that you can kind of get that same sort of stretch. And then making sure that every exercise that you're doing is not just balanced, but that the quality of the movements are similar. And I think that's the one area where physical therapy is really beneficial because a lot of my patients, say that, they work out a lot. And so why can't they just do the exercises at home? But generally, this is a problem more related to the quality of the movement patterns as much as it is just with the strength. And so it's not necessarily just doing 3 sets of 10, and getting stronger with your quad exercises, but it's really how all of the muscles, your core, the hip, the quad, the hamstring, the calf, all of those move together as a unit in a coordinated fashion that's really the most effective when you are looking for shock absorption and optimal running mechanics.
Yeah, and to do that, you need somebody looking at you while you're doing the exercise.
Exactly.
You need somebody
exactly.
keeping an eye on you, literally. Yeah.
Right, right.
Dr. Miho Tanaka is my guest. We're talking about all things orthopedic. If you have a question or comment, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Let's go to the phones to Mary, who's on the line from Baltimore. Welcome to the show with Dr. Tanaka.
Thank you. The question I have is that I'm a 79-year-old woman. I've been walking and sort of running, but running more in my head, for about 40 years. And I recently developed osteoarthritis in my left hip. I am taking bone supplements for it, but it still affects my my ability to walk, and I'm now using a flatter path than I have. My question is two part. One, should I just skip to get an artificial hip? Because I don't want to sit down. And, but I'm also concerned that someone's going to say, oh, you're 79, you should be, here's your Barco lounger, and, good luck.
And that sounds like really bad advice for a person like you, Mary, let me tell you. So, Dr. Tanaka, what do you think?
Yeah, well, first, I think it's fantastic that you have managed to stay active, and for such a long time. I think that's great. It's great for your health. Osteoarthritis is a really tough problem that tends to develop as we age, and so some people, have more of a tendency for it because there is a genetic component. But for a lot of us, this can be wear and tear. In terms of, when somebody goes on to get a hip replacement or a knee replacement. For whatever type of arthritis that they have, it really is dependent on how they are functioning, one, and whether it matches the type of lifestyle that they want to lead, and two, whether they've kind of tried all of the other treatment options before surgery. And so there are things, we just talked about physical therapy, and even though this is a problem of the bone and of the joint more specifically, the exercises around the hip or the exercising the muscles and strengthening the muscles around the hip can kind of take the pressure off of the hip, and as well as lead to giving you a little bit more flexibility for certain movements. There are also other options like medications and even injections, which can help with the pain related to the arthritis. But going back to your question of whether you should get this done, this is kind of related to what you want to be able to do afterwards. Of course, a hip replacement or a knee replacement isn't always a perfect surgery. It's not exactly the same as having your original joint. So that's where you want to really talk with your surgeon before moving forward with this to get a really good understanding of what your hip is going to feel like after the surgery and whether it would be better or worse for you in terms of the activities that you desire to get back to doing.
Well, I hope that's helpful, Mary. And if you're still with us, can you elaborate a little bit about when you said you're taking bone supplements? What kind of stuff is that?
I could do an infusion or I could do a once a week supplement that was prescribed by my physician. They tried to do the physical therapy, but that really didn't work out. That just didn't work out for, it was just kind of a crazy, I don't know whether I was at the wrong place, but it just didn't work out. So I started doing the supplements, and this will be about the fifth week on it. I'm trying to see, can I tell a difference or not? Oddly, once I walk, now I walk about 2.5 miles a day, and 2.5 to 3, it used to be 3 miles, but it was flat. It's flat. And the pain seems to dissipate when I start walking after a while. So I'm not sure what that's related to. But but I am taking this supplement, and I can't remember what the heck it's called. I apologize.
Yeah.
But,
well, gosh, Mary, good luck. It sounds like you're doing everything you can. And the fact that you're getting out there and keeping active ultimately is a very good thing. I would think so. Good luck, because I know it's frustrating when there are things you want to do that you're not able to do. But I appreciate that call. We have an emailer who's responding to me when I said you can't get hurt in a pool. I stand corrected because John says, Tom, those of us who are high-intensity swimmers, triathletes, can develop knee and shoulder issues in the pool. I'm a perfect example. And then he wishes me the best. Well, John, back at you. I wish you the best as well. My guest is Dr. Miho Tanaka. It's What Hurts Today here on Midday. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. So, Miho, we have an email from Jean, who's in Parkville, who says, I'm 79 years old, and I've been doing ballet for most of my life. And she has doing in quotes. Which probably explains the damage to my body. The most troublesome and painful problem is that the big toe on my right foot can't bend enough to stand on demi-point on the ball of the foot. So to do almost anything in ballet, you need to be able to roll through your foot using that joint, and it's essential for balancing. I went to a foot specialist, orthopedic doc, who did an x-ray and said there's virtually no cartilage, but there are little chunks of stuff in the joint blocking it from bending. The only solution he offered was to fuse the joint with a metal plate. So obviously this is the opposite of what I want, as it would prevent me from ever being able to bend the joint. So do you know if there are any other options that might allow me to regain the use of this joint? And you have treated any number of ballet dancers, haven't you?
Yes. Yeah. You know, foot and ankle problems in ballet dancers are, you know, one of the most common problems that we see just because of the nature of the sport or of the event. And once you start talking about what sounds like arthritis at the base of the toe, this can be very challenging. Now, it depends on the type of arthritis that you have and how progressed that it is. In some cases, you know, there are options to resect the bone spur, but really, if you have lost the joint space, which is what sounds like what you were told, then generally, you know, the fusion does tend to be, I'm not a foot and ankle surgeon, but, you know, minimizing the motion, which is the cause of the symptoms, is I think common practice. I personally do not know enough about the advances in foot and ankle surgery to know if there are ways to maintain your mobility and motion at that site while still putting fairly high demand, being fairly high demand and doing things like dancing and ballet on it. But certainly, you know, looking into kind of specialists, specifically in foot and ankle, and specifically foot and ankle surgeons who treat dancers, might be a good option to try to get some other possibilities to look into.
All right. Well, thanks for that email, Jean. Appreciate it. Here's another question about supplements. We were just talking about that with Mary in Parkville. This is an email from Jackie, who says, my dad is 77 and has been suffering from knee pain such that he needs a cane to get around. He walks every day, but he's not a runner and has never done high-impact exercise. I saw an ad for an organic balm that claims to make knee and other muscle pain go away. Is it possible that such natural products can really help, or is this just marketing? And it's interesting, Jackie's email is also something I'm thinking about, because yesterday, in all places, The Economist magazine, I wrote about creatine, which people are taking evidently in large quantities. It's, according to The Economist, a natural source of energy that helps your skeletal muscles flex. So what's your take on, you know, natural balms and creatine and that stuff? Are these things that some of your patients are trying?
Yeah, so when it comes to knee arthritis, you know, we really just break this down into kind of two categories of things that can be helpful. One is reducing the inflammation that's in the knee, which is the source of the pain. So that is, you know, associated with pain and swelling and those types of symptoms. And there are many ways to do that. And then the other category is to put less pressure onto the joint. So that could be resting it, that could be using an assistive device, you know, as he's doing, or even going back to doing other things like we talked about with physical therapy to build up the muscles that take the pressure off of the joint. And there are even things like braces. Now, when you go back towards that conversation about anti-inflammatories, there are multiple ways to do this. You know, I touched briefly on things like prescription medications, anti-inflammatories, injections to reduce the inflammation. And certainly there can be options for, you know, natural methods or natural types of medications that might have the same sort of anti-inflammatory effect that, you know, some of our medications that we typically prescribe might have. But unfortunately, there's really no way to cure the arthritis because it is a process of wear and tear. So I would say that, you know, that might not be the whole solution, but it certainly could be helpful in getting you to a better spot of reducing inflammation so that you are able to perform some of the exercises that might be helpful ultimately for the pain.
Is arthritis something that responds differently to oral medications as opposed to topical medications? I mean, this emailer mentioned a balm, a natural balm. Does it matter, generally speaking, one way or the other, how you deliver the drug? Or it's not a drug?
But the solution, I guess.
I call it the stuff.
The stuff, right? So the stuff, you know, for topical, it really depends. It just depends on whether it can get to that part of the joint. So with the knee, you know, it's typically pretty easy because there's not a lot of distance between the skin and the knee joint. Whereas, you know, for some people, I think it also depends on, you know, how you're built. For the hip, you know, that could be a little bit harder. So topical medications certainly do have effectiveness, but only when they can reach that part of the knee. And certainly some people do get a lot of relief with topicals from the knee. With the oral medications, that is more of a systemic effect. And so that can be a little bit more reliable in getting to the knee, but it can also go through other parts of the body. And of course, you know, we always have to worry about, even though the risk of side effects are low with any sort of anti-inflammatories, there's always, you know, things that we worry about with the heart and the kidneys and trying not to prescribe those medications in people who have issues related to that. And then of course, the strongest one or the most localized one is the injection, because that goes directly into the knee joint. And so that can be the most, the fastest acting and kind of the most concentrated. But any of those can work as long as they really can reach the joint, including the topical ones. So the knee is definitely a possibility. It's just a matter of whether you can access the skin around that area that's hurting.
Let's sneak in a call before we take a quick break. Let's go to Salisbury. George is on the line. Welcome to the show with Dr. Tanaka.
Good morning. Good afternoon, Tom and Doctor. I don't know your name, but that's not important right now. I have a frozen shoulders diagnosed probably 15 to 18 years ago. And I've been gotten a lot of suggestions. I've been to orthopedic surgeons. I've been to aquatherapy, other physical therapists in different states, and also what's the other thing I did? But they all told me there's really not much you can do about frozen shoulders. That still ring true today with all the technology that's changed over the years.
Gee whiz, yeah, 18 years. That's rough. Yeah. What do you think, Dr. Tanaka?
That is a long time. Frozen shoulder is, you know, another one of those really challenging conditions. It happens really without any sort of trauma or reason for it. You know, it's common you know, certain people have a slight tendency towards having this problem. But basically when it happens in three phases. So the first phase is the freezing phase, where you have a lot of pain and you're not really able to move the shoulder around and you think that you might have hurt it somehow. And once that phase goes away, then the shoulder starts to feel a little bit better, but it feels very stiff. So, you know, any sort of motion and getting it to a certain point, you just feel like it's stuck at that point. And that's the frozen phase. And then finally, the third phase is the thawing phase, which can take a long time. And, you know, this is a condition that in some cases takes, you know, 2 years, sometimes even longer. What I would say is that, you know, treatment options really depend on what sort of stage of that condition you're in. And even in the thawing phase, it does take a lot of active stretching, daily, 10 times a day stretching to really try to get through that sort of scar tissue that's essentially building up in the lining of your shoulder that's causing it to be stiff. But there are options like injections in some cases. There are assisted stretching programs. And in worst cases, if it really is persistent, if there isn't anything else going on and if this truly is the diagnosis, there are options for release. Essentially, it is surgery where you can kind of stretch out and maybe release some of that capsule that has become tightened. So this might be something that you want to explore, but probably the most important thing is to get checked and make sure that there isn't something else going on in addition, because, you know, 18 years, 16 years is a really long time to have that problem.
And George, just to remind you of the names, my guest is Dr. Miho Tanaka. She's an orthopedic surgeon and associate professor at the Harvard Medical School and the chief medical officer for the New England Revolution Pro Soccer Team. I'm Dolly Parton. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have more with Dr. Tanaka. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's What Hurts Today. If you've just joined us, my guest is Dr. Miho Tanaka, an orthopedic surgeon and former Division I college track and field athlete, by the way. She's answering your questions about orthopedic issues that you may be wondering about. We lovingly title shows with Dr. Tanaka, What Hurts Today, but it could be something that's been hurting for a long time or something that might start hurting if you do the wrong thing. You are welcome to answer that question by giving us a call, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. So we have another email from a dancer. This is Jan in Annapolis, who says, I've been dancing since I was 3 years old. And as an aside, by the way, I've been dancing since I was 3 years old. It has not been pretty, but that's a separate issue. We'll talk about that later. But like your caller, Mary, Jan says, I developed arthritis in the base of my big toe. A surgeon at Mercy Foot and Ankle Clinic here in Baltimore originally wanted to do a fusion surgery, but agreed to start by cleaning the arthritic spurs out of the joint, as that would be the first step towards fusion. That was 10 years ago, and I'm back to weekly ballet classes with full range of motion in my toe joint. So that's good news from Jan in Annapolis. I want to ask you, Miho, about an article you wrote for the Journal of Women's Sports Medicine about people's preference of the gender of their physician. You are one of the few women who has risen to the top of the field in orthopedics. It's a very male-dominated discipline in medicine. You and I have talked about that a bunch of times before. But you actually did a study about female patients and who they wanted to choose as their physician. And a lot of them really wanted to work with a woman doctor. What did you find?
Study, you know, as we were building out the women's sports medicine program, I think it was important to kind of understand who the audience or the clientele was and how we could best meet their needs. Because obviously all of us treat female patients, and you don't have to be a female physician or a surgeon in order to be able to take care of a female patient well. But we wanted to know if there were sort of gender-based preferences that existed. And so, you know, there is a little bit of a selection bias, meaning that, you know, all of these women chose to come to the women's sports medicine program. So by definition, they were kind of looking for something a little bit different. And basically what we found was that the majority of the women, not all of them, but a lot of them did come because they felt that they wanted to be seen by a woman. And there were different reasons for it. You know, we were looking at, you know, were they more comfortable with a woman? Did they think the communication styles were different? You know, did they have a prior bad experience, you know, somewhere else, and so they wanted to see a woman. There were lots of different sort of answers that we saw, but really the point of this is to try to understand, you know, if it is a communication issue, then what should we be doing across the board, not just, you know, in our female clinicians, but in our male practitioners as well, in terms of how we can bridge that gap and make care better for women. So that was kind of the goal of that paper, and it was really interesting to see some of these responses that came in.
Let's go to Jean, who's on the line in North Baltimore. Jean, welcome to Midday with Dr. Tanaka.
I have a question about a rotator cuff and arthritis. I'm in my 70s, and this just happened within the last, I would say, 8 or 9 months. My doctor has said that I'm too old for rotator cuff surgery. 60% it would work, 40% it wouldn't. So currently I'm doing some PT and exercises at home. Are there any other things I should be doing?
Yeah, so, you know, rotator cuff problems can be pretty tough, and I'm assuming that you were diagnosed by MRI. It is fairly common for people over the age of 60 to actually be diagnosed with a rotator cuff tear, just because it is a condition of wear and tear. So unless you fell or, you know, landed on your arm, most people, about 60 to 70% of the people over the age of 60 are going to have some sort of tearing of their rotator cuff, even if they have no problems with their shoulder. So we don't always necessarily go and repair every tear that we see, especially in the age group that's over 60, because so much of it can just be a natural finding that we see even in asymptomatic shoulders. But in the cases where it is symptomatic, again, an anti-inflammatory to get rid of, you know, the soreness and the inflammation, and then a good course of physical therapy really is helpful. And the physical therapy is not just to stretch it out, but to strengthen the muscles around it in the shoulder so that you're able to do the motions that you need to do, like reach over your head and reach behind you, without having pain. And in most cases, that does end up being effective. But certainly, you know, if you're still having symptoms despite that, you know, there are options to look into things like injections as well before moving on to surgery.
Well, thanks for that call, Jean, and good luck to you. I know these things can be difficult and drawn out sometimes, but that's interesting, Mio, that you say that 60 to 70% of people over the age of 60 might encounter that problem. That's, you know, I guess the old adage, getting old ain't for the faint of heart. let's go to Jackie, who's on the line in Baltimore. Jackie, welcome to the show with Dr. Tanaka.
Oh, thank you. This is wonderful. I'm having back issues, and I've had a couple of epidural steroid injections. The last one I had was unbelievably painful, and they told me that that's because I have arthritic things in there. But I'm just wondering, and my back is getting worse, is it possible that those injections can make it worse? And I don't understand how arthritis can... They said it's, they have to keep poking around with the needle to get the right place. So it's over my head, and I don't seem to be getting answers. Did you follow my question?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Jackie. I appreciate it. So, Dr. Tanaka, what do you think?
Yeah, so arthritis is... you know, it can mean a lot of different things. And when it's specifically in the back, it typically refers to the fact that, you know, the discs that are in between the bones can be degenerated. And oftentimes, you know, the injections around that site can be helpful with pain. But another thing that you see with arthritis is that you can get bone spurs. And so sometimes in those cases, the bone spurs can actually get in the way of doing the injection, especially if the anatomy kind of becomes a little bit abnormal due to the fact that, you know, the bones are wearing down and you're starting to get additional bone spurs and things like that. But injections are kind of the first line of treatment, that and physical therapy for people who have arthritis of the spine. Like with rotator cuff disease and other types of conditions, you know, it is more and more common as you get, you know, past your 40s and into your 60s. But if it's not effective, or if you feel like you're doing all of these other things and you're still having symptoms, then, you know, you could consider talking to a spine surgeon. Obviously, that's a big jump, but certainly that would be the next step if you were to continue to have problems related to this.
Okay, good luck, Jackie. Appreciate the call. So, Mijo, in our last minute or so, I want to ask you about all of the devices that are out there that folks who exercise use, you know, Fitbits and Apple Watch and Garmin is a company that makes runners watches and stuff. Do you think there's utility in some of those? What do you tell your patients?
Yeah, you know, I think the device itself is not going to get you into better shape or to make you healthy. But what it can do is it can make you more aware of your habits, your movement patterns, how you're eating or how you're sleeping. And so I think that's important for several ways. One is that, you know, one of the biggest issues that we see with training and overuse injuries is that you're either doing too much or you're ramping up too quickly. So really keeping track of the volume of exercise and the types of activities that you're doing is a good way to see, you know, to see that and to make sure that you're not, you know, doubling and tripling your volume in a short period of time. I think the other thing with some of these tools is that, you know, we're starting to learn more and more about the importance of these other factors in musculoskeletal health. So even though I do knee surgery or shoulder surgery, you know, I now have nutritionists and sports psychologists and sleep specialists as part of our team who are really helping to treat the athlete as a whole. And we know that there's a lot of relationships between these other elements of our health that we don't necessarily think about that can influence our knees and our shoulders and our hips. So I think it's a great way to kind of be more aware of what we're doing and our overall health.
Dr. Miho Tanaka. She's in charge of the Women's Sports Medicine Program at Mass General in Boston. She's a professor of medicine at the Harvard Med School. She's also the chief medical officer for the New England Revolution Pro Soccer Team. Thank you so much, Miho. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. I really appreciate your wonderful and important information.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Midday goes back to the garden with Carrie Engel from Valley View Farms and Farmer Chippy from the Plantation Park Heights Urban Farm. And coming up next, it's Fresh Air at the top of the hour after news. Today, the author and activist Stacey Abrams talks about her latest book. Thanks for joining us here on Midday. I am grateful. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.
This is 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.